Our next speaker is Rodney Fort. Rodney is professor of economics at Washington State University. He received his bachelor's degree in environmental studies from Utah State, his MA in economics from Montana State University, and his PhD from Caltech. His articles have appeared in numerous scholarly journals, and he's recipient of numerous awards. His research areas focus on the regulation of public policy as well as the economics of sports. In addition to his book that I mentioned, Hardball, with Jim Kirk, he's also the co-author, also with Jim Kirk, of the widely acclaimed book Pay Dirt, which is also, in fact, if you haven't seen Pay Dirt, it really is one of the really exceptional books in sports. I'm pleased to introduce Rodney Fort.
I have to have some notes. I just can't do that like Roger can. I would like to thank everybody at the Institute for allowing me this opportunity to talk sports. Life can't get any better, can it? I mean, make a career out of talking about sports. I would like to echo Roger's sort of sentiment about the way we think about sports. I think about sports like my favorite Gary Larson cartoon, right, where you get this little primordial beastie climbing up out of the ooze. And the reason that they're doing it is there's a foul ball, right? And they got to climb out on the land in order to get their ball back so they can keep playing baseball. But I'm reminded during the strike, you know, Henry Aaron, there's an economist named Henry Aaron, believe it or not, at the Brookings Institute institution. And he was being interviewed on, he was on C-SPAN, but being interviewed by congressional hearings. And he pointed out, he sort of lightly kidded, you know, the subcommittee by pointing out that baseball at that time was about just a little under a $2 billion industry. And that the envelope industry in America was worth about $2.25 billion. And at the paper, if you threw in paper cardboard boxes, it was way over $8 billion. And then who knew what happened once you threw the entire, you know, sort of paper industry in there. And he told Congress, quit wasting your time on this. You got bigger things to deal with than investigating, you know, the baseball strike. But as I was watching, I thought about it just like Roger did. Yeah, but there's no cardboard box section in the newspaper. So I was perfectly glad that Congress was there worrying about getting baseball back for me. It's dangerous to talk too much, well, to talk about sports in an open forum because everybody knows more about it than you do. But I'll forge ahead anyway because on the particular things that I'm going to talk about, that might not be true. I want to just sort of walk through Hardball. And I hope that doesn't bore some of you who might have already read it, but I'm not going to stop there because I'm also going to continue on because the criticisms of that work that have come back to me have to do with, just some more, you know, pointy-headed intellectual white tower economists, you know, making absurd prescriptions about how we ought to fix something in the world that, you know, it'll never happen. And I am that, but I didn't stop there. It was just a good place to stop the book. So I'll continue on after Hardball. Sports leagues exist to facilitate the market power of their member teams. If anybody tells you any different, it's time to find someone else to talk to. That's why they exist. That's what they do. We like to think, you know, that, well, they have to, the peculiar economics of sports, they have to have leagues in order to facilitate, you know, the cooperation that goes on in leagues, in order to facilitate, you know, a schedule and to have rules and officials and an appeal of the rules and set up championships. And all of that is true. It's exactly true. But you've already hit, even in that simple description of why leagues have to exist, you've already hit an economic issue. The scheduling issue has to do with why do they make New York play Milwaukee? Right? They would rather not, right? They would rather only play other teams that generate large revenues. And so there's this wonderful, if you haven't seen the NFL report, you know, that comes out from the NFL, and the inside cover of it just recently was a big, long statement by George Halas in front of Congress. And he talks about how come they had to do that. How come they had to make all the big teams in the NFL play all the little teams, you know, in the NFL? And the answer was, well, without those little teams, they didn't really have a league, and fan interest would disappear. That's strictly an economic issue. And so you can't even, you know, sort of get into the very basics of sports leagues without hitting economics already. And after that, right, where you have all these joint venture activities against, in the sense of who gets to be in the league and who doesn't, where they get to be located, we get to talk about their treatment, their behavior towards TV, how they put it up for auction and why they structure it the way they do, their behavior towards labor for years and years and years, extracting as much of labor's value as they possibly could, and then their treatment of host cities, as Roger just described in gruesome and gory detail for you, so I won't get into that. In all of those activities, the only reason that there is for leagues to get together and act on the behalf of their member teams is that the member teams as a group will make more money that way than if they acted individually. It's the only reason. All of them could make their own TV contracts. All of them could deal with their own labor issues. All of them could deal with their own host city. All of them could decide where they want to be located without league approval. The only reason to get in the way of all of those activities is because it generates larger profit. And then as long as they have a reasonable sharing mechanism, the rest of the teams will go along with it. The consequences of this league behavior are geographic market power for teams. Market power in league output. Marketing, bargaining power over labor, and then bargaining power over their host cities, and power over my favorite owner, which is Al Davis. Okay, I love Al Davis. I've never met him. I'd love to. I'd work for him for free if he just gave me the chance to have lunch with him sometime. I'm absolutely serious. And I would love to do that because here's a guy who, right, looked at what was happening to the way leagues were treating him, and decided to take action that was in his interest rather than the interest of, say, the New England Patriots or something like that. Okay. Those consequences are the things that fans see. That's why I went through that little, primer on leagues. The consequences of this market power are things we observe every day. Prices. High sports prices. Duh. When you create monopoly, expect them to charge in excess of marginal cost, and expect them to charge it in as many and as large a variety of ways as they can possibly dream up to extract as much money from the people who are now held captive to their activity. And if you don't expect them to do that, then I think you should step back and read Adam Smith again. Okay. High salaries. Oh, sorry, I want to do the result, and then what happens if you give it a dose of competition real quick? Well, what if teams are free to, sort of locate and play in leagues whenever they want to? And well, then, of course, wherever there are positive profits, where prices in excess of marginal cost, then that's the sure lure for another team to come in and take up some of those profits. And so with a little dose of competition, I'm not going to get specific about how to do that shortly, but with a little dose of competition, right, those profits go away, prices come down. That's the essence of competition. Salaries. High player salaries. Yes, of course they are. I mean, look, they're an extremely scarce talent to begin with. So even if the world were a competitive place, like it might be, say, in the motion picture industry, they're still going to make a lot of money because they've got something special that we're willing to pay as individuals lots of money to see. Okay? But think about how much more than that they make now. Because there's two things they fight over, right? Players fight over, this battle is pretty much won in American sports, but it's a real interesting topic in European sports. They pretty much won the issue of capturing their contribution to the revenues of the team, that they generate for the team. The old marginal revenue product story and the monopsony exploitation of players that died with free agency, that part of it. But now, why would you stop there? I certainly wouldn't, because now I know that what I'm contributing to is also generating positive economic profits for owners. Money in excess of what it takes to get them to continue to go ahead and put, baseball out there for people to enjoy. I want some of that too. Why wouldn't I? And so as long as there's market power on the output side and there's a battle between, in a collective bargaining sense over that part of the pie as well, then players are going to make even more. Now what happens if there's a good stiff dose of competition? The market power side, right, on the output goes away. There's nothing really for unions and management to fight over anymore except pension plans and, healthcare, non-wage benefits. Okay? And so competition will drive, well, it depends on whether it'll drive salaries down or not, because it also depends when there's competition, there's more teams out there bidding for players. And so, we'd have to wash those things out. But certainly their collection of the kinds of things Roger was referring to, the large subsidies that go to teams when stadiums are put in place, and it goes away. And I'll get to that in a second about stadiums. Competitive balance. What about competitive balance? Right now, what drives competitive balance problems, say in baseball? Salary imbalance. No, absolutely not. All competitive balance issues derive from the geographic monopolies that are given to teams. So when I put a team in New York and I put a team in Milwaukee, I have created competitive imbalance. I make more money in New York, I can field a better team. I'll buy more talent and that'll be that. Okay? Yeah, well, if there's, because of the way that I've put those teams out there, if New York can handle five teams instead of two, or Southern California can handle seven teams instead of two, those revenues are going to be driven closer and closer to equality, and competitive balance become less and less and less of a problem. More and more teams will be buying closer to equal amounts of talent. And so a good dose of competition will take care of everything except, right, the real for real willingness of, to pay in terms of size. It'll take care of those things. Well, what about location, expansion, migration of teams? We either love it or hate it, depending on whether we're getting one or losing one. Okay. Well, if the world were a competitive place, then if there was a margin there at which I could, create a Rod's baseball team and put them in place, I would. And there would be another, right, baseball team in another place. And we would expect under competition that most, if not all, viable markets would indeed have teams. They wouldn't be being held in reserve strategically by leagues, for example. How come L.A. is empty and Houston got a team? Good question, huh? Well, it's a two-edged sword. I mean, on the one hand, L.A. Open is an awfully nice, right, hole card to be played by existing teams against their current host cities. Okay, fine, I'm going to L.A., and that's viable. That's a believable threat, okay? Because it's empty. There's no NFL team in Los Angeles. Don't count the Chargers. Don't get me wrong, I love the Chargers. But don't count them as being in the L.A. market, okay? I think you're going to see an extremely large jump in the kinds of things Roger was describing for you because L.A. is empty. Everybody now, right, will be, sort of setting up the L.A. market as the next place they're going to be. Ken Behring already did it. He was in the truck, leaving, heading south for Hollywood Park. And apparently he had some stadium deal cut with Hollywood. But he got dragged back because of league, choices. Now, if it's really the case that there's an open, a viable open location, and there's competition in the world, team moves in, that's the end of that. And as many as are viable will survive, and they will be right in all of the viable locations. Which leads us to the stadium mess. How come existing teams have the leverage that Roger described for you? How come they're able to extort and extract? Part of it, I'm going to get to shortly, but I'll give the punchline away, right, has to do with state and local politics and the way those issues work out there. But the other part of it has to do with the fact that by creating exclusive markets for teams and an artificial shortage of teams, it's completely believable that I can pick up my team and go someplace else and have them build me a city. That, that scarcity of teams is maintained by leagues on purpose so that they have the ability to extract larger and larger subsidies from host cities. Now, in a competitive world, what will easily happen? When I would try to extract a subsidy, some lurking, circling, right, school of hungry sharks would see one of two things. One, it's entirely possible, right, that a new stadium is a valuable thing to a team that they might actually bid for if they could, had that chance, and that they could make a go of it buying those rights from localities. But certainly we would at least expect the subsidy to fall in locations where a new viable team would actually build its own stadium, for example. It would much rather make a bid on an existing stadium, and we might actually see subsidies start to turn into revenue-generating devices for state and local governments instead of, albatrosses around their neck. So, prices, salaries, competitive balance, location, unrealized expansion hopes, all those kinds of things, the stadium mess, all of those observed outcomes happen because of the way leagues do business. And I would argue, and have argued repeatedly, if there was a good stiff dose of competition, nearly all of them would just simply go away. There will be distributional consequences. Can I use that copy? Sure. Hardball? Mm-hmm. This is the most wonderful quote I think I've ever found. even if I quote something that's in my own book. Free market economics is the process of driving enterprises out of business. Sports league economics, Tagliabue invented that term, is the process of keeping enterprises in business. So there's nothing like a sports league. Nothing. Okay, and he's absolutely right. There's nothing like a sports league. So when he runs that story, though, what he's trying to accomplish there is, if there was competition, there would be a dramatic rearrangement in who has teams, and some teams that exist right now, because the cross-subsidies are large enough that would disappear under competition, would lose their team. We can all envision our favorite, barely hanging on by a fingernail team, like the Pittsburgh Pirates, or, take your pick. Okay? There would certainly be distributional consequences. I've heard arguments like, well, all you want to do is create Walmart Pro Sports, right? Competition drives things to the lowest common denominator. They're just wrong, because in addition to Walmart in the world, there's also Neiman Marcus and all other kinds of places to shop. And the obvious example is the example of the continuum now between major league sports and minor league, or in college between Division I and on through. There's lots of competition there in college sports, but we haven't seen it all devolve into Walmart college sports by any means. Not as long as we're willing to pay for it. As long as we're willing to pay for it, they'll produce the quality that we demand. That's another fundamental market outcome. But there will be distributional consequences, and I think that's really what Tagliabue is saying. He's saying, boy, don't let those guys who want to talk about competition, don't even let them get their foot in the door, because some of you will lose your pro sports team. Okay. Prescriptions on how to do the competition vary. Community ownership. A lot of minor league baseball teams and sort of the Green Bay Packers, right, are community owned, for example. So there's one way government could – these are all, sort of interventions by government to fix this, all these problems that we see that have to do with market power. Okay. So they parallel, right, the institutions that are already out there to handle market power problems. We can buy our utilities from Company X, or we can have a municipal water system like I have in Pullman, Washington. We can produce it ourselves, right, collectively speaking. So community ownership is one alternative. An administrative agency approach has been offered up by people like Mr. Roden at the New York Times. A public utility approach, Andy Zimblist, offered up an idea in his book, Baseball and Billions, to create that baseball is special and important, and that makes it a public commodity. Okay, it's not as important as electricity and water, but, right, nonetheless, it's that special thing, and we ought to regulate it since it has market power, and we want to let it have market power, apparently. We ought to regulate it then just like any other public utility. So that's been offered. And my favorite, of course, is in the Ira Horowitz, Roger Noll tradition from their congressional testimony in 1976 to just split the leagues up. I just love this idea. The first time I heard it, I had to go look it up because Roger told me that, well, I think Ira and I talked about that once. So I found it, and it's in their hearings in 1976. The first time I read it was by a lawyer, Stephen Ross, and he made that suggestion to break up the sports leagues. Might have been in your book, Paul. Yeah. And it has all kinds of beautiful aspects that I don't want to get into because some of them are just technical. But the basic idea is they used to be separate leagues competing, and then we made them one league again. So I just bust them up. Let's go back to that competition and just see what might happen when there's a little competition in the world, economically speaking. This is where hardball ends, and now I need to get on with, more about that kind of a prescription, because all of those prescriptions lack acknowledgement of the politics of the situation that's going on, okay? To argue or to suggest that, all we need is a little antitrust, right, is in fact futile. It didn't bother Jim and I to stop there because it's just just economists talking about how to fix a market power problem. And those are tried and true methods that will work. Well, okay, can work. But they're never going to happen in 10,000 years. And that is what most of my work lately has been about. I got a chapter in Paul's book about antitrust and some other stuff. I'm going to say this just so you pick the symposia up. Not necessarily to do my, to read my junk. But the University of Texas, University of Toledo Law Review has a symposium out on sports. The Marquette Sports Law Journal has just done a symposium on sports. The Scottish Journal of Political Economy has just done a symposium on sports in Europe. A lot of the same issues going on there. Okay. What you need there, though, is a quick dose of rational actor politics. And I think you actually understand this quite well. I mean, politicians make choices because they like to be politicians. They want to be elected. They want to be reelected. They make choices that on net, not in total, but on net, keep them in office. So they're perfectly happy to irritate a whole bunch of people if on net the people who reelect them are happier. Okay? So as long as that's happening, then politicians, right, will make choices that enhance their net voting gains, their chance for reelection at the margin. But that's an extremely powerful piece of logic, okay? Because even though it seems simple, it's powerful for two reasons. One, it helps us to understand why we see the things we do. Part of my explanation for why we see we tax average citizens to give money to millionaires is because we've always done that. Okay, we do it in a system of electoral politics that has lots of redistribution goals, because that tends to keep politicians reelected. Okay, okay, it does that for you. It gives you an explanation of some outcomes, and it also helps you to understand what you're going to have to do in order to have some impact out there in the world of sports. And the answer is very plain and simple. You're going to have to change the electoral margins that politicians face. Right now, we see those electoral margins favoring monopoly sports leagues. And as long as monopoly sports leagues put a team in a particular place for a particularly powerful politician at the point in time of expansion or team movement, then the politician will be perfectly happy with that. They get to, you know, stay in office. Okay? So it's going to help you understand what you have to do about it. And the answer is you got to change those margins. Now, that's a glib statement, in a sense, but it's not one without some potency, because we've seen exactly those kinds of things happen in the old KidVid activity, and the movements against the Federal Trade Commission when they were making choices that were hurting kids. We also saw it in the entire environmental movement, as a matter of fact, as an example of changing political margins in large ways. So it can happen. But it isn't going to happen because, 400 people go onto some internet thing and say, let's buy the Jets. That's not going to happen. That's not going to change the way sports worlds work. So if you want to have some impact on sports outcomes, then you're going to have to become politically viable, re-election potent groups, and then start hitting on your congresspeople, right, to change the margins that the team owners face. And until that happens, it's just going to continue on the same. Don't count on referenda. Right? My work in referenda tells me that there's absolutely no relationship between having a referendum and having a responsible stadium outcome. Okay, none. And in fact, what's really telling about that work is that if you look at the ones that failed, right? The people spoke. Half of them get funded, over half of them get funded anyway, and at amounts larger than they were on the ballot. Okay? So maybe all a referendum does is generate some information for people who love stadiums. I'm not a dismal scientist. I'm not a dismal guy. Okay? But sometimes when you use economics, you arrive at conclusions that aren't exactly, sort of uplifting. Okay? Especially when you mix in a dose of politics. Thank you.